case number 215811, United States of America versus Harold Smith. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Reach, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Eric Reach from Johnson City, Tennessee, representing Harold Vernon Smith, the appellant, by CJA appointment from the Eastern District of Tennessee. We've raised two issues, and with the court's indulgence, I would like to address what my second issue in the brief was first, that being the introduction of Mr. Smith's prior convictions. The issue is about the cumulative effect of all nine of Mr. Smith's prior convictions. Mr. Smith did not stipulate under Old Chief. He's certainly not required to stipulate under Old Chief, and I don't believe that any reading of it requires him. And I believe this issue is going to be coming up more often since the rehab decision from the Supreme Court requiring knowledge to be proven. I think those cases are now making their way up to the appellate courts now. And admittedly, he could have avoided all of this with a stipulation to Old Chief. However, that just because he doesn't stipulate doesn't mean that we don't have rules of evidence. Doesn't mean that we don't still look at these convictions and their cumulative effect and whether or not they're prejudicial. Each one is probative, not denying that at all. However, when we start introducing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 of them to prove one point, essentially, knowledge, and status as well, for really 2 points.
So what would be your limit? Would there be a numerical limit as to the number of felony convictions when there's no stipulation?
And, Your Honor, I don't think there can be a limit. I don't think we can say 1, 2, 3. I don't think that's fair, and I certainly wouldn't think the court would make that limit. I think we have to look at when each conviction on its own, at what point the district court has to make a decision. What point are we hitting too much? And I don't think that's invading, the district court reasoned that it would be invading the province of the jury by limiting the government. And I don't think that's invading the province of the jury. Prejudicial evidence is prejudicial. That's the district court's decision, is to make that.
How were these convictions introduced into the evidence at the trial?
Two ways. There was a pin pack from Mr. Smith's time in the Tennessee Department of Corrections that had his picture and his record. And also by individually introducing his judgments of conviction from the various courts, most of which were in Tennessee. He did have one in North Carolina, as we'll be discussing.
So the prosecutor just said, do you recall being convicted of this?
Mr. Smith never testified.
Yeah, oh, right. Yeah. Good point.
So it was introduced.
So he just introduced it individually, one after another.
And it was introduced at the very beginning of the government's proof. Not saying the government chooses when to introduce those, but it was introduced at the very beginning of the proof. And we have to recall, too, Mr. Smith was arrested for a parole violation. So that was coming out as well. So there was already proof of him being on parole. There was also that he was one of the convictions is actually a life sentence from an old Tennessee law, the three strikes and you're out law, that's actually no longer in effect. So Mr. Smith had one conviction very clearly states life sentence. And Mr. Smith was in a parole violation.
So your argument is that's the one they should have chosen and just introduced that conviction, or?
Your Honor, I don't think that, again, going back to Judge Mathis's question, that I don't think we can limit the government, but I think that certainly does put.
If they had chosen that one, would you be here arguing, well, they chose the most prejudicial one?
Your Honor, no, I wouldn't.
You don't get a life sentence for a minor crime.
I would not be here, Your Honor. I mean, I wouldn't, because I think at that point I wouldn't have the argument that we have a cumulative effect of it. Government's entitled to prove.
What did his counsel argue at trial then should be introduced instead of all, 11 or whatever number we have of convictions?
Well, Your Honor, I think that certainly we can't put a limit on it, but I think we
did.
Was
it just a general objection, Your Honor, we can't introduce all these convictions, but the counsel didn't say just offer these up?
Your Honor, I was actually at trial counsel,
oh, you
so
were.
I did, Your Honor. I didn't file the motion, but I took over for the federal defender after it was filed, so I argued it before the trial. And the argument at trial was that, Your Honor, I don't know where the limit is. Please look at this and make a decision on it. Let us know where the limit is.
So you left it in the, you were arguing for it to be in the district judge's discretion, yes, as to which ones would be introduced, but it should be fewer than the number that were.
Exactly.
So you didn't say a particular number.
I did not, Your Honor. The court, I believe the court asks me at one point in time, what do you think? And I said two, but that was more of a, I don't know, Your Honor. I need district court to make this decision for us. And I'm raising this issue that there is at one point that we're piling on. The point's proven. And I don't know, and I don't think that we can, each case has its own set of circumstances. Each case has its own life to itself. And I don't think we can say, government, you know, to pick the best one and put it in. I'm not trying to argue for that.
But now, if we're, you want us to reverse the conviction because nine? Is it 11? 11 is too many.
Yes, Your Honor.
So if we're, if you want us to do that, we would need to say how many. Why is 11 too many? Would 10 have been okay?
I think we'll have to look
at. So at some point, somebody's either going to have to draw a line or leave it in the discretion of the district court. So help us do that.
Your Honor, I don't think that we can say, I really don't think that there's a way for this court to say three's enough. I don't think that's possible. I don't think that, and I don't think the court would do that. I do think, however, that there can be a guidance to the district court to decide what, how many are there, what type are they. Obviously, Mr. Smith's convictions were not of the very prejudicial in and of themselves. They were all for robbery, escape, things like that. Nothing that was particularly shocking to the conscience. But I think we have to look at each case, how many convictions are there, what type of convictions are they, what proximity in time are they to the event.
Let's say I'm going to give you my pen for a minute. Let's say I want to write an opinion for you. Hypothetically speaking, what should it say?
I think we have to look at district court. You need to look at the number of convictions that the court, that the government is seeking to put in, what type of convictions they are.
But why is this over the line?
I think that we have to look at, I mean, 404, 403, and 404, if it's prejudicial, it's prejudicial. And I don't think that we can, I think we just have to provide guidance to the district court. I think in this case, it went too far.
Because?
Because nine convictions spanning over a time period of 40 years simply show, is going beyond the point of proving knowledge under rehab or status as a convicted felon. It's just simply showing that he's a bad person. Is simply what it is. The point was, is proven. There's a point when the district court can look at it and say, it's proven. This is what, you've proven your point, government. But after this, we're piling on.
Introduced against your client, other, take the convictions aside. Why isn't this harmless error based on the evidence?
Good question, Your Honor. And harmless error is not something that we can always take a look at. Sometimes we have to say, well, and the court did give a limiting instruction. I will certainly admit that at my request. However, I think that the proof at trial was that Mr. Smith was found in coming out of the woods. There was a ruse put together to get him come out of the woods. But at trial, there is very, very little photographic evidence at the scene of Mr. Smith. There's two pictures of Mr. Smith who were put on Facebook by the Greene County Sheriff's Office and two pictures of the bag that was found in the woods, and that was it. There were no pictures of the bag opened at the scene. There were no pictures of the gun even at the scene. And that was the crux of the, that look, you know, we're in a state of police work where pictures are taken of everything. This court sees the records of these cases. Pictures are taken of everything.
Does any of that go to the point at issue here? That goes to whether or not there was evidence that he possessed ammunition and a firearm.
Your Honor, I think where I'm getting to that is that with it being not, it's not harmless error because we're not talking about an overwhelming amount of evidence.
Well, what that about the jailhouse phone calls? Doesn't he essentially fess up to being a felon in possession and those
Honor,
calls?
He was identified by the, his voice was identified by the detective, one of the detectives that testified. Mr. Smith did not testify, and that was obviously a strategic move to not do that.
But the jury's entitled to credit that as coming from him.
Certainly, but after they've already heard he's got 11 prior convictions at this point in time. That was done after he was all after all these in, these were all introduced.
So let me see if I just understood what just happened here. In response to Judge Bush's question about the conversation, do you agree that in that conversation your client basically admitted that he was a felon and he knew it?
He admitted that in if we take credit for the, which the jury obviously did take credit for the detective identifying his voice, he admits that I had it on me, is what he admits. He doesn't admit to being a felon in that, yeah. In that, obviously it's from a jail, but
okay,
he was
fair enough
in trial. But he does admit I had it on me, and I believe my time is up. I have 5 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I'll address the other issue with that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Reach. Mr. McLaurin.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Luke McLaurin, and I'm here on behalf of the United States. Mr. Smith's convictions and sentence should be affirmed for two reasons. First, the district court properly admitted the 11 prior convictions evidence at trial. And second, the district court correctly concluded that Mr. Smith's prior North Carolina conviction for assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill, inflicting serious injury, is a violent felony under the Armed Career Criminal Act. Now, I'd like to start with the evidentiary issue. And as I think this court's questions pointed out, Rule 403 leaves a lot of discretion to district judges to police this issue and entrust them with discretion because these are difficult questions to answer. But Rule 403 also, as this court has recognized, tips the balance in favor of admission. The rule says that evidence should only be excluded if its probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. Here, we don't believe that the probative value of this evidence was outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice, let alone substantially so. And I think that's because when you look at this evidence in the context of this case, it was very highly probative of two crucial elements that the government had to prove: Mr. Smith's status as a felon and his knowledge of that status. And in particular, I'd like to focus on that knowledge element because it's a newer one. The Supreme Court introduced that in the Ray Haif case. And knowledge is a very difficult thing to prove, as courts have long recognized. It's hard to show what is in somebody's head, what was in somebody's head, what they knew. And so knowledge is always shown by circumstantial evidence. And it's very difficult ex ante.
How do you deal with our decision in Jenkins? You didn't even address it in your brief. I was just wondering, because that was relied upon in the appellant.
Well, I think Jenkins involves an entirely different situation. There,
that was a knowledge issue, though, wasn't it? An intent issue.
It was a knowledge issue, but the difference there is that the government already had lots of other evidence of knowledge. I think the problem in Jenkins was that the government had a really great case on all of its elements, and this information about this prior conviction was really just piling on. Here the issue is the government didn't have other evidence about knowledge precisely because the defendant refused to stipulate. And I note that the record is very clear here. The government offered this defendant multiple times and multiple opportunities to stipulate. The district court actually talked with the defendant on the record, made sure that he was knowingly refusing to stipulate. The district court even advised the defendant that it would be in his best interest to stipulate to felon status and knowledge, and the defendant refused to do so. It was only because of that, because the government didn't have this other available proof through a form of a stipulation, that we then had to go to the conviction records to show that he had these multiple prior convictions.
You would agree, though, that at some point, is the government's position that you can just introduce every conviction you can find on the defendant, regardless of how many there are, to prove this element?
No, Your Honor. We acknowledge at some point a court could say, I mean, this is why we have a district court to police this. At some point, you know, there could be too much. The question is, was this evidence unduly prejudicial here?
Is that true, even if the records don't describe the nature of the crime or the, you know, what if the records just said served, you know, 5 years on a felony conviction 11 times? That'd be a lot of times, but a lot of years.
I'm not sure.
Are you saying it's just that there is some number, or is it oh, well, if the records describe the graphic nature of the offense, it was a particularly heinous offense, and it describes the nature of the offense, that could be too much? Or are you saying a felon with a long record, many convictions, there is some number of convictions that would be too many?
I don't think I can say that there is a precise number that would, I mean, as the court pointed out during the questions with my opposing counsel here, it's very hard to identify any sort of precise number and put a line and say, well, you know, this is just too many. I think the court would have to balance in each case. The court is going to look at the Rule 403. And certainly, Your Honor, I think introducing details, lurid details about prior convictions, that could be over the top and prejudicial.
Here there's no details of the conviction.
No details whatsoever. The government did not go into any of the facts of the prior offenses. We simply pointed out that we introduced, the only thing we introduced were the judgments. That's what he's objecting to. These are the official certified judgments of the conviction.
Did it name the crimes?
They did. Yes, they did name the crimes. And we think that was important because, as Old Chief actually points out, certain types of offenses are offenses that are, you know, more likely to be the kinds of offenses that result in more than a year in prison. They're likely to meet that threshold, and somebody's less likely to forget that they've been convicted of certain more serious offenses. So we think that the nature of the offenses is important.
You have an alternative argument on harmless error, and I'm wondering who bears the burden to show harmlessness? To do harmless error, we'd have to assume there was error. We'd have to assume that the admission of these convictions, the prejudicial effect of that substantially outweighed their probative value, right? And then wouldn't you have to show that that error did not substantially sway the jury's verdict?
Yes, Your Honor. Generally, that is how the harmless error analysis works. The government would have to show. And we do think we could show that here because, as I believe Your Honor's pointed out, the evidence here regarding the possession of the firearm was pretty overwhelming. I mean, this defendant was caught red-handed holding a firearm.
Sure, but there's another element of the offense, and the other element of the offense is, did he know? And we've already determined, when we assume error, that the prejudicial effect substantially outweighed the probative value of the evidence. So how can we say the jury was definitely not prejudiced?
Yeah. And also, you just admitted in your argument that this was the only way that you could get it proven is through these convictions. I think you said that you didn't have any other, that's how you distinguish this case from Jenkins.
Yeah,
you said this was the only way the government could prove knowledge of felony status was through these convictions.
Well, and also to prove felony status. I mean, we have to show that he is a
So if we were to hold that the government went too far here, it sounds like you've already put yourself in a box where you really can't prove harmless error, can you?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think their whole argument is they're conceding that at least some of this conviction evidence could come in. And we think that, I mean, if you acknowledge that even some of this could come in, we think that would show his, like, the court would be finding that if the court finds that that this was unduly prejudicial, it would be acknowledging that at least some of the evidence would have been sufficient, that there was sufficient evidence to show knowledge.
What you would be saying is, without saying how many is too many, this is too many, but they could have admitted at least one, so therefore it's harmless.
Yes, Your Honor, because I think...
But we have to look at whether what happened to this actual jury, right? This actual jury heard 11, and that's too many.
We don't...
I'm not saying it is, but...
Yeah, I mean, the jury, I mean, again, when you look at the prejudicial probative balance... It's not just whether there's prejudice, it's whether the prejudice is unfair. We admit these were prejudicial. They were prejudicial precisely because they were probative of two critical elements of the offense, felon status and knowledge of that status. Something is only unfairly prejudicial when it tends to suggest a decision on an improper basis.
Yeah, but now you're just saying there was an error.
I thought you wanted, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I misunderstood your question. I thought you wanted me to address that.
It seems like your argument, it rises and falls on whether or not there was error. Because it seems like to me you're saying if there's an error, probably is not harmless because you have to, you always have to look at the convictions. And I don't see how we can just come back later and say, well, you could have introduced fewer convictions, but the fact of the matter, the government didn't. And I think you have to look at what was actually presented at the trial that was admissible in order to determine whether an error is harmless or not. I think you can't do a hypothetical of what was could have been done but wasn't done.
Well, I think if you're finding that it is prejudicial because there was too much, there's an acknowledgement that at a certain point there was enough. And so the question is, in the context of the evidence that was presented, was this additional stuff that you're saying is too much, was that the thing that put the defendant in a position where his trial is fundamentally unfair and we can't rely on the verdict as being accurate? And I just don't think you can say yes given all the evidence that was presented against this defendant in terms of the overwhelming evidence of his possession. And the court would at that point be admitting that there was sufficient evidence of knowledge presented.
So Judge Larson at one point asked your opposing counsel how he would write the standard for when you have multiple convictions. How would you write the standard for us if we were going to rule your way as to where you draw the limit for the number of convictions?
Well, I don't think the court should set a limit for the number of convictions. I think that the standard is Rule 403 and that you entrust district courts to police this and identify when evidence is too much, when something is unduly prejudicial. And
what should we consider then? What's relevant?
I think you need to consider what were the probative value of it. Like, and so, for example, when you're trying to establish knowledge, the nature of the prior convictions is relevant to the probative value, as is the situation of the defendant. I think it's important to remember this defendant was 70 years old when he went on trial. Several of these convictions were fairly old. It would have been very plausible for him to argue, hey, I forgot about some of those convictions. And so the government didn't know ahead of time, you know, what the defendant would be able to, you know, how he would be able to attack his knowledge.
The defendant did not take the stand, right?
The defendant did not take the stand, but the district court...
It would be one thing if you had a defendant sitting on the stand and you're showing him these convictions one after another. That could be pretty probative how he reacted to seeing this on the stand. But it wasn't that way. It was just a clear... It was just records that you were introducing
records,
one after another.
Yes, they were introduced. And, I mean, again, the district court's trying to make this decision ex ante. And the district court...
And, of course, you can't know whether the defendant's going to choose to take the stand later.
We don't know whether the defendant's choose is going to take stand. We don't know if the defendant's how he's going to attack his knowledge. And so ahead of time, the government's just trying to look at, you know, we've got a very old defendant here. We have to show knowledge. We don't know the quantum of evidence that the jury is going to expect to see. We don't know the quantum of evidence ahead of time that is fully going to convince the jury. So we're going to put in the evidence that we have, and we put it in the least prejudicial way possible. We just put in the conviction records. We didn't put in any details about these convictions. We did include the names of the offenses because we believe that they were relevant and very probative of knowledge. I mean, for example, for these convictions for escape, the fact that you have escaped from prison does indicate that you knew you were imprisoned at some point. And the fact that some of these offenses were more serious are the kinds of offenses somebody is less likely to forget. Again, you have to consider the defendant was 70 years old. He could have reasonably argued he forgot about some of these prior convictions. We don't know ex ante how all this is going to play out in front of a jury. And so what we did is we tried to present the evidence that we had in the least prejudicial way possible. And I think it's important to recognize that the district court issued a clear limiting instruction here. That was timely, was issued right after this stuff came in, and it directed the jury to only consider it for the specific purpose that it was allowed to consider it for. And while that may not fully eliminate the risk of unfair prejudice, it certainly minimizes it a great deal. And again, the standard requires that the unfair prejudice substantially outweigh. And here, we admit, again, these were prejudicial because they showed his knowledge and intent. But that's fairly prejudicial because those were critical elements that the government had to prove. And the quantity of evidence here was not introduced in a way or designed to paint the defendant as a bad person.
and it was in fact presented in a way that would minimize that risk. The limiting instruction minimized that risk. And so the district court, in conducting that balance, said that the balance favored the omission, and we think that this court should defer to the district court's discretion on that point. Unless there are any other questions about this issue, I'm happy to address any questions the court has, but I'll just briefly, with the remaining time, address the second issue. We think this one is pretty straightforward. I think the title of the offense actually says it all. The elements of the offense are quite clear. Assault with a deadly weapon, with intent to kill, inflicting serious injury. I think the three of those elements clearly show the force. The assault with a deadly weapon, infliction of serious injury, clearly meet the force prong of the use of force clause in the Armed Career Criminal Act. And the intent to kill is right there in the statute. It's in all the court opinions. His reliance on Jones is misplaced for all the reasons we set forth in our brief and are outlined in the district court's, the Fourth Circuit's Townsend decision. I'm certainly happy to answer any questions the court has on that point, but unless there are any other questions, we'll rest on our briefs, and we ask this court to affirm Mr. Smith's convictions and his sentence.
Okay. I don't think we have any other questions. Thank you, Mr. McLaurin. Mr. Reach, do you have a rebuttal?
If I may just briefly address the first issue I raised, but the second issue that we've talked about, the Armed Career Criminal Act in relation to Mr. Smith's conviction for North Carolina. It's very simple. It's very straightforward. The highest authority on any state statute is that state Supreme Court. And admittedly, the Jones decision, the sentence that I rely on, is dicta. It's not the holding of the case.
For a different crime, too.
It is for a different crime. Well,
it doesn't have the intent to kill element.
It does not, Your Honor, and I'm perfectly cognizant of that. Perfectly admit that, with all candor to the court. But courts of appeal, as I know this court does, carefully choose the words they use because they get analyzed, they get parsed, they get brought up in other courts. And that court, Supreme Court of North Carolina, chose to put that offense, this offense, in that sentence. And it did that for a reason. And I think that we have to look at, they chose to put that in there, that it could be committed with a lesser, with culpable negligence. And we either disregard that, or we accept that that's what they said, and we use that to analyze a statute. That's the argument.
Then the dicta and Jones, what's your strongest support that this particular crime does not require intent?
That's the only thing I can really say, Your Honor, is that that's what the Supreme Court of North Carolina has stated. That's what it can be committed. Their analysis could be used to find culpable negligence in this particular crime with the intent.
But you agree that there are other North Carolina Supreme Court cases, both before and after Jones, that say that this particular crime requires a specific intent to kill.
It does require intent to kill, and as my opposing counsel said, it's in the name of the statute. I mean, that's perfectly admitted, and I can certainly, the Townsend decision goes through that. But I think I don't agree with the Townsend decision in completely disregarding the North Carolina Supreme Court statement that, yes, this could be used, even though it is dicta and it's not a different offense. But I think they chose those words for a reason. They chose that sentence for a reason. There's no other reason to put that in there unless they didn't mean it. And if while it may not be precedent necessarily because it's dicta, anything that happened before that, anything that happened after that, I haven't seen any cases in North Carolina where this particular crime comes up. I haven't seen any Supreme Court cases where it comes up. There are some appellate court cases, but they don't have the same, a factual basis that would support that. And I think we would have to engage in some very hypothetical analysis to try to come up with something about that. However, what I come back to is they chose those words. They're the highest authority on that particular statute, and they said it could be committed with culpable negligence. So I think we have to at least acknowledge it's there and that we need to listen to what they said. That's the argument on that, and it's very straightforward, and I certainly acknowledge that the statute, without the Jones decision, I wouldn't even be able to make an argument, quite honestly. Just perfect candor with the court. And that's the reason why we brought that issue.
Anything else on the other issue?
Your Honor, I think we've said everything that we could say on the other issue. I spent a lot more time on it than expected. I appreciate the court's questions on that. Otherwise, unless the court has any other questions, I will rest on the brief and appreciate the court listening to us today.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Reach, and thank you for accepting the CJA appointment. And we will take the case under submission.